Craft Beer Radio, Episode 1.
Welcome to Craft Beer Radio, the show for craft beer and the craft brewing industry. My name is Greg Weiss.
And this is Jeff Baer.
And today we're going to be talking about the Hefeweizen, the German wheat beer. We're going to be reviewing two beers, Penn Brewery's Penn Weizen and Pyramid Brewery's Pyramid Ale Hefeweizen. We're going to also talk a little bit about the brewing process and do a little segment we call Macro Muck, where we tell you what the macro breweries are trying to sell you. So, Jeff.
Before we get into the show, we would like to thank some of the people that have gave us feedback for the show. We actually had 145 people download our podcast last week.
More than we expected.
We'd like to thank Fosco and Jason from the Kick-Ass Podcast for the kind words they had to say about our show.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
And also Jeff from the Good Beer Show.
And thank you very much, too. We appreciate it. And so today we're going to be talking about, like I said, the Hefeweizen, the German beer. Hefeweizen means literally yeast wheat.
Hefeweizen is an old German ale that uses wheat in yeast that has a distinctive character.
Now, you say it uses wheat. Now, why do they use wheat?
They use wheat because that was available in that region.
I know that there was a German purity law of some sort, right, that allowed barley. Did it allow wheat also?
The German beer purity law is the Reinheitsgebot, and that was passed in the year 1516. And it stated that for your product to be sold as beer, it could only contain barley malt, hops, and water. And like I said, this beer has wheat in it. From the research that I've done, that they allowed some cereal grains, such as wheat and rye, to be allowed in beer and still call it beer.
You know, I noticed you said obviously grains and hops and water, but you didn't say yeast.
Yes, in 1516, they didn't know about yeast yet. When you wanted to start a brewery or brew a batch of beer, you would brew up the wort and you would just sit it out, and hopefully it would start spontaneously fermenting. And once you had that first batch, you had a pile of white gunk at the bottom of your beer, which you could use to... They found if you pitched your second batch of beer on top of it, it would start fermenting a lot faster.
I see.
And they knew the white stuff was good for fermenting beer. They didn't know it was yeast. They didn't know how it worked.
So, I mean, we got to have a lot of thanks for Louis Pasteur for eventually figuring that out. Okay, so I guess we'll jump right into the beer itself. We'll start with Pyramid Brewery's Pyramid Ale Hefeweizen. Now, this is These are lower alcohol beers than we tried last time. This one is 5.2% alcohol. It's certainly not the 9 that the double IPAs were. Essentially, not a lot of hops in these beers, right? This is you're using just Liberty hops and not a whole lot of hoppy character.
Yeah, Hefeweizens typically have a very subdued hop character. Not much at all.
And we should also mention that the glassware that we're pouring these in are this tall, slender glasses with a sort of a wider opening at the top. That's just sort of... Well, why don't you describe what it's for?
Yeah, it's called a Weizen glass, or a trumpet-style glass. And it's made to accentuate the head on these beers. These beers have huge, fluffy heads when you pour them, and these glasses help accentuate that. This beer, when we poured it, had a nice head. It's a little creamy. The appearance of the beer, this one's surprisingly clear.
Yeah, it's a wheat beer. Very clear and sort of almost pale yellow. Doesn't have much of a smell to it. I smell definitely some yeast coming out of it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. To me, the aroma, it's a slightly citrusy, a little bit of lemon to it.
Yeah, I can sort of smell that. There's obviously, like we said, a very little hop character in these beers, so you're not going to get that kind of hop wallop that you get with other beers.
One thing we'd like to mention is we must have picked the week to do wheat-style beers.
Indeed.
Screwtops, Good Beer Show. Everyone was doing either Belgian whites or wheats. The difference between the two is that Belgian whites are almost always spiced with spices like coriander, where Hefeweizens and German Weizens are not. They could just get the character straight from the yeast.
I see. The yeast adds a lot of character to the beer, right? It's part of the specialness of the beer itself.
This Hefeweizen yeast gives it flavors, which sometimes be called medicinal or clove-like, and also it has fruity esters, which gives it some characteristics that you might consider to be like bubblegum, vanilla, or banana.
I really do like banana in this style beer. I think it's a really good taste that goes along with it. You sometimes notice people putting fruit in their beer, like little pieces of lemon or orange inside Hefeweizens. We don't advise that.
Yeah, I like the fruitiness that you get out of the beer itself.
You know, the first taste I'm getting when I taste this, and it's pretty strong, and I really do like it, is a vanilla. It's a strong vanilla with a little bit of a yeast backbone.
Yeah, has a pretty clean taste. Has a very light mouthfeel, a little bit of a yeasty taste to it, and it's very clean.
Which is good. I mean, one of the things that we recommend you do with Hefeweizens is, when you get to the end of the bottle, swirl it up a bit and try to get a little bit of the yeast that should be on the bottom of the bottle. These beers should all be bottle conditioned. Try to get a little bit of that yeast in with the beer. It'll aid to the look of the beer. It'll cloud it up a bit, and it'll also add to the taste. It's sort of expected that the yeast itself will add some of the taste of the beer. And as we're pouring a little bit more now with the yeast in it, we can see it definitely get a lot cloudier and, in a sense, a lot more appetizing.
Yes. Yeah, thank you, Greg. I would have, with all this podcasting going on, I would have forgot about swirling the yeast into suspension when you pour this beer. A lot of bottle-conditioned beers, you want to decant carefully. A lot of beer styles isn't supposed to have all of the yeast suspended in it. This is the one style where, when you're pouring it, you want to get all the yeast out of the bottle.
And like we said, it definitely looks a lot better now with all that yeast in there, and it definitely alters the taste significantly.
Yeah, it tastes a lot better. This beer, like I said, had a very light mouthfeel before. It had thickened up now that we got some of the yeast in suspension.
I still taste that vanilla. I almost taste a little bit of nuttiness in there now. I can taste, like you said, there's a little bit of that, the clove that comes from the phenolic flavor from the yeast.
Yeah, it's a little bit spicy, a little bit peppery, like the clove that Greg mentioned. It's very crisp, very refreshing beer. Mm-hmm. If you listen to the Screwtops podcast, they tasted this very same beer, and they thought it was a great summertime beer. I have to agree with them. It's a very good drinking beer for when you don't want something heavy.
Yeah, I like the profile. I like the way it feels in your mouth. It's got a nice carbonation. It doesn't go too overboard, but Hefeweizens always have a heavy carbonation. It's sort of the character of the beer itself. We should mention what serving temperature we should have this at. This is a cold beer.
Last week, when we did the Imperial IPAs with the higher alcohol, we mentioned they should be served in the mid-50s. This style of beer is meant to be served colder. We suggest 45 to 50 degrees.
Right out of the fridge.
It's also a beer meant to be drank fresh. It's not a beer that ages very well. You want to drink it fresh before it loses any of its character.
So what goes well with this type of beer?
Being a German beer, German cuisine goes well with it. Now, that's pretty broad. If you were looking for individual dishes, fish, salads, poultry, and shellfish all go well with this beer.
I could see that. If you're looking for a cheese, you're looking for sort of a light cheese.
Yeah,
maybe something with a little bit of tanginess to it.
Yeah, something with a little bit of tanginess. Brick cheese, a feta.
Feta would be perfect. I really think feta would go very well with this. I really do like this a lot more than I was expecting to. Once we get the yeast in there, it really changes the taste of the beer significantly. And like I said, I taste that vanilla. I taste the clove and the pepperiness. The finish is light and very soft. I really like that a lot.
Pyramid Brewery has 4 breweries. Their original one was in Seattle, Washington. They also have a brewery in Sacramento, California, Berkeley, California, and Walnut Creek, California. Their annual production is 123,000 barrels a year.
That's a lot of barrels.
Yeah, it's a pretty big brewery. It can't be called a microbrewery by the production standards, but it's certainly still a craft brewery.
Right.
They put out close to 20 annual and seasonal beers. They opened in 1984. This Hefeweizen has won several awards. It won the gold medal for the style at the 2004 Great American Beer Festival. It won a bronze in 2000 at the World Beer Cup, and a silver in the 1997 World Beer Tasting Championship.
So a real award-winning beer. I really do like the Hefeweizen style. It's certainly a more subtle style than other beers. It doesn't hit you in the face with flavor, but there's a lot there to really enjoy, a lot to sink your mouth into.
Out of lighter styled ales, this one is one of my favorites because of the character that the yeast gives it. The lemony citrus that you get out of these beers, I think, really hits the spot sometimes. Pyramid Brewing Company has a wide distribution area. It's available in 26 states.
It's a lot of states. I mean, they brew 123,000 barrels, so there's a lot of brew to go around.
Yes. And some of their other beers, one of my favorite is their Snowcap Winter Ale.
I don't think I've ever had that one.
Okay. I haven't had too many of the Pyramid beers either. I've had their ESB. It's good. It's not super duper, but it's good. Actually, I need to seek out some more Pyramid beers because this one's pretty good, and I don't have most of the ones on their schedule under my belt.
Yeah, this one, I'm pleasantly surprised. I think you and I were both expecting this one not to be quite that good, and really, it is very good.
Yeah, if you read some of the reviews that we were looking at, it's not a horrible Hefeweizen, but it wasn't one of the top-ranking ones. Most of the top-ranking ones are European Hefeweizens, but there was a couple American microbrews that ranked higher than this one.
I think the archetypal Hefeweizen is Franziskaner. That's the one that people, most people, when they think about Hefeweizen, that's probably the one they most think about.
Yeah, Franzi is a very popular Hefeweizen.
And delicious, I might add. Well, I guess we should move on then to the Pennweizen.
Yes, Pennweizen is brewed by a Pennsylvania Brewing Company. They're right here in our hometown of Pittsburgh. They opened in 1986. They're the first craft brewer in Pennsylvania. Pennweizen is available all year round, and we're going to crack it open right now.
4% alcohol in this beer, less than...
Well, this one was listed on the website as 4% alcohol by weight, and the slacker that I am didn't do the conversion to alcohol by volume. I think it goes up, but I'm a slacker, so...
They call this a Bavarian Weizen. I wonder why they do that.
From the research that I was able to find, it's another name for pretty much the same beer.
I see. Now, again, if you pour it without swirling, you're going to notice it's sort of pale, and it is probably not going to have the same taste. Fortunately, the glasses we're using right now are a little bit small, so that's why we don't quite get all of it in the first pour. But now the second pour, here we go. We're definitely getting the yeast in here. Definitely getting a different color. Another really nice-looking beer, really cloudy once you get the yeast in there. The head is staying around, although it's dissipating.
Yeah, the head was a little smaller on this one. Might have had to do with the pour. I've had this off draft and has a wonderful head.
A very, very different flavor in this
one. Yeah, this one has a much stronger flavor. You get all kinds of spices and citrus out of it.
Immediately, I'm definitely noticing a lot of spice right away. I'm trying to figure out what that taste is because there's something unique in there. The clove is much stronger here. I don't notice nearly the kind of vanilla that I was. Maybe a little bit of a nutmeg?
Yes, nutmeg would describe it good. The flavor of the beer is a lot drier than the Pyramid. This one has all kinds of flavor. The Pyramid compared to this one doesn't stand up very well.
No, I'd have to agree. Getting some other fruitiness in here, maybe a little bit of banana on the tail end, and a little bit of lemon when you first start to sip. Wow, that's really good.
I had this beer last weekend at the Penn Brew Festival. I knew how good it was, and having it again, it's one of my favorite beers from Penn, if not the favorite.
I mean, this is really a world-class Hefeweizen right here. This is... It'd be hard to find one better. I mean, I think that Franziskaner, like you said, is the archetype one. It really is kind of the standard by which all are measured up to, but this one measures up quite well.
And when you said hard to find, you might not be kidding. When I picked this beer out, I thought it was more widely available. So a lot of you listeners probably won't be able to get this. You can only get it in Pennsylvania, Maryland, New York, and Florida.
Interesting. So if you have any friends around here and you don't live in this area, see if you can get them to send you some of this because this is exceptional.
Yeah, you've probably heard of the Penn Pilsner. That's their biggest selling beer, and people out of the region rave about trying to get a case of that. If you ask me, this beer knocks the pants off the Penn Pilsner.
Absolutely. The mouthfeel is very good, too. It's got the very... It really has the Weizen feel down. A little bit less carbonated than the Pyramid, I'd say, but it's smooth. It's not necessarily smoother, but it's kind of spicier.
Yes, it's most definitely spicier. That's going to be a character that they use a different kind of yeast. They probably use a more authentic German-style Hefeweizen yeast, where Pyramid probably uses a more Americanized style of yeast. Penn Brewery brews all traditional German beers, and they're good quality beers. Another one that's my favorite is their Christmas beer called St. Nicholas Bock.
I'm not really a big fan of that one. I have less and less been a fan of the very sweet kind of syrupy beers. Now, the double IPAs we had last time were an exception to that. Less and less am I getting into those type of beers. And I guess it's just sort of as the palate grows, it also shrinks in some places. So this beer is so good, has it won any awards?
Yes, it's won several awards. In 2000, it won the Great American Beer Festival gold medal in the style. And in 1997, it won the silver medal. It won the U.S. Beer Tasting Championship in 2004, 2003, and 2002 as the grand champion.
So you can see why this type of beer is really popular for this time, why so many other podcasts are doing this beer, because it kind of fits the hot, sweaty nature of the spring and summer. This is a good summer beer.
Yeah, it's certainly light and refreshing and fits that time of year just fine. You know, not the time of year you want to be drinking a barley wine.
That's for sure. Okay, now we're going to talk a little bit about the brewing process. Now, Jeff, in addition to you being a craft beer enthusiast, you're also a home brewer.
Yes, I've been home brewing for almost 3 years now, and I've gotten quite involved with it. It's a great hobby.
I have joined him on, I think, 2 brewing occasions, and I really enjoy it, too. It's very fun and educational, kind of like Mythbusters.
Nice. Yes, compare us to a top-notch cable network show when we're on our second podcast. As we mentioned when we were discussing the Rheinheitsgebot, when you brew beer, you deal with 4 main ingredients. That is the malted barley, the hops, the water, and the yeast. The malted barley, notice I don't just say barley, I always say malted barley or barley malt. The reason for that is plain old barley by itself isn't a very good ingredient for making beer. It has to do with the chemicals in the barley itself.
As I understand, it's got a lot of starch in it.
Well, there isn't much starch in the plain old barley. The malting process, what that means is you get the barley grains wet, and they start to germinate, and you dry them out as soon as they start to germinate. And that has a much higher starch content than the plain barley does that's straight from the plant. The reason you need the starch in the beer is because later on in the process, you need those starches to turn into sugars, which the yeast turn into alcohol down the road.
I see.
Everyone who brews uses malted barley. There are huge malting houses that what they do is they take in raw barley, they malt it, they pack it up, and ship it out to breweries. The next ingredient is hops. Hop is it's an herb. It's a vining plant. It has little flower-like cone-shaped flowers. They have tons of aroma. If you've been listening to our last podcast, we mentioned how some have citrusy flavors, others have piney flavors or spicy flavors.
Now, I understand that the hops are actually related to the cannabis plant, which, as you may know, have interesting chemical properties.
The hops don't have any hallucinogenic properties or whatever else you may want to think of the other plant that Greg was referring to, but they do have some lovely flavors to them.
And resinous. I think that's the thing about both what you traditionally think of as cannabis and hops is they're very resinous flowers.
The third ingredient is water. And you might think water is a very important ingredient if you listen to some of the advertisements that you see around. Pure mountain spring water, whatnot. Most breweries, where you get the water is not very important because they filter their water, reverse osmosis it, and then they add the minerals that they want to the water to make a character of beer they want. For example, Boston Beer Company, the company that makes Sam Adams, they get their beer from the Boston City Water Supply. No mountain spring water there.
Uh-huh.
And they filter their water, and then add the salts to the water to give it the character they want for their beer.
But Coors gets its water from the Rocky Mountains.
I suppose they do. And if I'm not mistaken, Coors is also brewed in Virginia. I don't think they ship boxcars full of water from Denver to Virginia to make their beer.
I'm sure whatever they ship, it's ice cold.
Okay, the final ingredient is yeast. It's a microorganism. It's technically a fungus. And what it does is it eats the oxygen and sugars out of the beer and leaves alcohol and gives off CO2.
Yeast, to me, are just absolutely fascinating creatures. They're single-celled fungus now. They used to consider fungus a plant, but it's not a plant. And it's not an animal. It's kind of a hybrid almost. They found it's almost related to insects in the way that fungus reacts. So they made their own kingdom, which is fungi. And yeast, specifically, like you said, they eat oxygen and sugar, and they release carbon dioxide and alcohol. A lot more carbon dioxide than alcohol.
You'll notice that talked about different kinds of yeast giving different characters to the beer. So back to the brewing process now that we know all the ingredients that we're going to use. What you need to do first is you need to turn those starches, malted barley, into sugars. So that's a process called mashing. And what that is, you add hot water to the barley malt. It needs to be in a fairly small temperature range, typically around 158 degrees. At that temperature, enzymes in the barley malt start converting the starches into sugars. A typical mash is 45 minutes to an hour or so. Once that's done, you do what is called sparging, where you sprinkle hot water on top of the grains. You also let the water that's in the mash tun, which is the vessel where you do the mashing, to drain out.
And essentially what you're doing here, I'm sorry, is you're extracting all the sugars and all the kind of flavor from the barley.
Yes, you're basically rinsing the sugars out of the barley, out of the mash tun, into your brew kettle. Once you have your liquor in the brew kettle, you start boiling. The reason you got to boil beer is because the hops, the oils in the hops, are not water soluble. When the liquid is boiling, a process takes place which is called isomerization. And this is when the hop oils get infused into the liqueur. And at this point, we're going to start calling the liqueur wort. It's spelled W-O-R-T, but it's pronounced W-I-R-T.
Wort.
So wort.
Wort.
Yes. The longer you boil, the more oils that get absorbed, and you get different characters from the beer. When we were talking last week about the IPAs, we talked a lot about how the Dogfish Head was continually hopped, and it adds the bitterness to the beer, and at the end you get the aroma.
Now, I know that when we were doing our brewing for your beers, we were putting in hops at the beginning, and then at the very end we were putting in hops. Now, why do we do it that way?
The hops you add at the beginning gives a different characteristic to the beer than the hops you do at the end. The ones at the beginning add bitterness. This is because the other characteristic, the flavor and aroma characteristic, it's very volatile. And when it's in the boiling liquid, it gets boiled off rather quickly. So when you put hops in at the beginning of the boil, all you get is the bittering element of the hops. When you add the hops at the end of the boil, those oils that give you the flavor and whatnot aren't boiled off, so that's what gives you the flavor and the aroma of the beer.
And when Dogfish Head, they do the continuous hopping, it changes the process a bit and gives it that sort of the strong hop character throughout.
Yes. Once you're done with the boiling, the next step is to add the yeast and get to the fermenting process. But you can't add yeast to hot wort. It'll kill it. So you need to cool the wort to about 70 degrees before you can pitch the yeast into it.
Now this is essentially, you have this wort is a warm, once you get it down to temperature, it's a warm sugar starch solution. It is microbial heaven.
Yes, yes. Yeast and bacteria both want to get in there and just eat all they can. So at once you cool this down, you know, from the boiling, you have to be very careful about sanitation, because if you get some bad bacteria in there, they're not going to make you sick, but they're going to make bad beer.
It's going to taste awful.
During the boiling process, most of the oxygen is worked its way out of the wort, so it's not ideal for fermentation. You need that oxygen. Some brewers do this by shaking or stirring it. Others inject pure oxygen into it. That's what I've started doing, and it's helped me make better beer. The reason is because there's two stages that the yeast do during fermentation. There's the aerobic stage and the anaerobic stage. The aerobic stage is where the yeast is taking in the oxygen and multiplying. So you put in, you know, a million yeast cells, and they make themselves into 10 million yeast cells or something along the lines like that. Once they're done multiplying and consuming the oxygen, they start the anaerobic stage. That's where they eat the sugars, and they give off the carbon dioxide and the alcohol in the beer.
Right.
Fermentation for most ales takes about a week, a little bit longer, and after that point, the yeast start settling out of the beer and falling to the bottom. After that, the beer can be kegged or bottled, and you know, after a few weeks of conditioning, depending on the style, it's ready to be served.
Right. Now, we discussed bottle conditioning last time, in which you actually add a little bit more sugar, and you let the yeast sort of build up again and start producing more carbon dioxide and a negligible amount of alcohol inside the bottles themselves at pressure to infuse the beer with carbon dioxide. Now, there is other ways of doing it, which is what most brewers do, which is they just sort of add the carbon dioxide to it once they get the first fermentation done.
Greg's right. When you add the sugar, it basically wakes the yeast back up, and they eat a little bit more of the sugar, and they give off a little bit of CO2, and since the bottle is capped, that CO2 gets dissolved into the beer. You know, that's what gives you a bottle carbonated beer. If the brewer's kegging, or if they're serving you a filtered beer, or commercial breweries need to turn over the product quickly, they'll force carbonate it. So under pressure, they'll inject CO2 into the beer, and it'll get dissolved that way. They'll either bottle the beer while it's already carbonated, or they'll put it in kegs. No kegs are keg conditioned, really, except for cask ales. They're all force carbonated.
Now, let me ask you this question about force carbonation versus bottle conditioning. Do you think that bottle conditioning adds like extra flavors to a beer that wouldn't be there if you're going to force carbonate? Or do you think it's just a question of how you want to do it? Either way, it doesn't really matter.
Well, there's also a difference between force carbonation. There's two different kinds. You can have force carbonation unfiltered, and you can have force carbonation filtered.
Right.
The filtering takes out the yeast. When you take the yeast out of the beer, the beer basically starts dying.
Okay.
It's going to start degrading over the time. bottle-conditioned beers that have the yeast in it, they do sort of an upkeep on the beer. They keep it maintained, and it'll last a lot longer.
I see.
And it'll do interesting things. It'll change character over years. You know, the hops will mellow a little bit. The roasty will get stronger, or, you know, you'll get more prune flavors. It depends on the beer. You'll get all kinds of different character out of it.
It happens even though the yeast is essentially in suspension and suspended animation?
Yeah, but it still does a little bit of maintenance. You know, it keeps the beer from, you know, from dying and going bad. But a filtered beer has a definite shelf life. But if you have a bottle-conditioned beer, and it depends on the style, like the Hefeweizens that we had tonight, they were bottle-conditioned, but they're not meant to be cellared because of the style.
Mm-hmm.
But most ales that are bottle-conditioned, they can be cellared, and they might be best fresh, some of the styles, but they won't go bad. They'll be interesting later.
I see.
Like one of my first homebrews, it was a brown ale. It was my first homebrew. It wasn't really good, but it was drinkable.
I liked it.
Okay. It was interesting because I kept some bottles around for over a year, and just noticing how it changed, it got better, and then it started getting worse. So bottle-conditioned beers still have a shelf life, but they don't go bad as quickly as filtered beers do.
I see. You said there was another way that brewers could condition?
Brewers could bottle their beer. They could force carbonate and not filter it, which is almost like a bottle-conditioned beer. It's unfiltered, so it still has the yeast in it.
Which will settle.
It'll settle. So it'll do that maintenance on the beer. And there's also the whole argument of filtered beer versus unfiltered beer on taste. And I'm a big supporter of unfiltered beer because when you take out the yeast, you like in these Hefeweizens, that's a huge flavor component of the
beer.
And you're not going to find very many filtered Hefeweizens, but if you do, it's going to taste like a light beer type thing because, I mean, that's a huge flavor component.
Right. That's an interesting lesson in brewing there.
Hopefully I covered everything. Hopefully I didn't make any mistakes. If you have any comments, though, email us. We got a little bit of feedback last time, but we'd like to see more, you know what you like, what you don't like.
If you have any suggestions for styles for us to cover?
Yeah, if you want us to cover a certain beer style and it's available in Pittsburgh, we will check it. And if it's not and you want to send us a beer, we're not going to send it away. You can email us and we would give you the shipping information.
And that's beer@craftbeerradio.com.
Yes.
And our last segment here, we want to talk a little bit about what we call macro muck. This is sort of a segment where we talk about some of the stuff that macro beers do and the macro beer companies do to kind of hook you in or try to get you in with crazy marketing campaigns or whatever. Today we're going to be talking about Budweiser Select. This is a fun topic because, I don't know, you've probably seen these commercials, and this is being advertised, brilliantly I might add, it's being advertised as this kind of special blend from Budweiser. This, I think they say, brewed for a crisp taste that finishes clean, this sort of special brew from Budweiser. This is their low-carb beer. Don't make any mistake about that. This was brewed to be their low-carb beer while the low-carb craze was going on, the whole Atkins phase. And what they did is they realized that the low-carb beer phase was getting out of the way. And like we said, in the brewing, beer is essentially liquid bread. I mean, that's what you're making. So how do you make low-carb liquid bread? Well, you just take all the flavor and taste out of it completely. That's what they're doing with this beer. And they're marketing it absolutely brilliantly compared to normal, the other low-carb beers, which I think Rolling Rock has one and Miller has one. Michelob has one, right? This beer it's a beer in name only. I think it best can be described as alcoholic carbonated corn water.
It would be rice water, probably.
Rice, well, the taste, it sort of a vegetable taste.
It had a cooked vegetable taste, yes.
We tried it beforehand just so we could, you know, see if it was all it was cracked up to be. And
yeah, can you believe it? Greg paid $1.50 to Anheuser-Busch. He is evil.
I've paid more to Busch in the past. But this beer is unique in how flavorless it is.
If I had to sum this beer up in two words, would be that they are marketing sophistication.
Absolutely. This is spectacular marketing for a really poor beer. You have to appreciate how well they're marketing this. Because I've heard of people who said, yeah, I tried Budweiser Select because it was, you know, their crazy new beer. I just wanted to try it out and it was okay. Just people who don't really know anything about beer. They don't know necessarily what they're supposed to look for in taste. They just taste this thing, they get their alcohol from it, and that's it. it's marketed brilliantly for that. It's trying to bring off the sort of champagne-like sophistication.
I noticed when I was looking at this bottle of beer that if you compare this to a traditional Budweiser can, it's very different.
Absolutely.
Budweiser can, the red and white label, it's very blue-collar. It's a working man's beer.
Right.
And this bottle, it has the clear adhesive labels. All the lettering is gold. It has that fancy little crown thing they came up with, and it's also embossed on the bottle. You've seen the commercials and all the hype about crisp taste, no aftertaste, but I mean, this is, you know, they're just marketing sophistication, if you ask me.
Absolutely. There's nothing to appreciate, really, about this beer other than the marketing. It's just a brilliant job of marketing right there. The fact is, like we say, this is their low-carb beer. This is meant to be a beer to even surpass Bud Light in terms of how low-carb it can get.
Yeah, I didn't even know that this was supposed to be a low-carb beer until Greg did the research. I thought Budweiser was just sticking to their guns and saying the Bud Light was their low-carb beer.
It's interesting to see how these macro breweries will try to hook you in and try to say that they're coming up with something new and different when really it's just that their original marketing idea for this beer kind of fell out of the window while they were developing it. And so they said, okay, well, how can we market this stuff that we've been making? And they came up with an absolutely brilliant way.
Yeah. Just so you know, I think the main reason we're talking about this is because I'm a huge fan of marketing and commercials, and I think Greg is as well.
Absolutely.
My only complaint about the commercials on TV is they let them run and they get stale. But I love watching new, good ads. What's next, Greg?
What's next? Nothing's next. That's it.
That's it. Okay.
Craft Beer Radio out.
Seacrest out. We hope you'll join us next time for another fine episode of Craft Beer Radio.